Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip.
In this episode, Dr. Hope Christie meets Dr. Carolyn Dunford and Dr. Melissa Prunty. Carolyn has been an occupational therapist for 35 years, specialising in working with children and youths and their families. She is currently a reader in occupational therapy at Brno University, London. Carolyn has a varied clinical and academic background, having worked in the NHS for many years as an occupational therapy clinician researcher. Other roles include Head of Therapy and Research at the Children's Trust charity and Senior Lecturer at York St John University. Carolyn is passionate about promoting practice that supports children and young people's participation in the daily occupations that matter to them. Carolyn is founder of the community of practice known as Mind the Gap, supporting clinicians to deliver evidence-based interventions and closing the research to practice gap. Dr. Melissa Prunty is the divisional lead for occupational therapy at Brno University, London. She is a children's occupational therapist by background and completed her PhD on handwriting difficulties in children with developmental coordination disorder, DCD, which she undertook at Oxford Brookes University. Dr. Prunty has worked in a variety of children's services and specialises in working with children with coordination difficulties. She founded the Children's Occupational Therapy Research Clinic at Brunel, which investigates key skills and participation in childhood, including handwriting, activities of daily living and cycling. The clinic currently offers placements to occupational therapy students at the university. Separately, Dr. Prunty co-leads the development of wheelchair basketball and disability sport on campus.
Brilliant. Welcome, Carolyn and Melissa. Thank you both so much for joining me today to talk about developmental coordination disorder. So I think we'd just start off with a really very basic question, but can you please define for us what developmental coordination disorder is?
Yes, I'll certainly do that for you, Hope. So developmental coordination disorder is a neurodevelopmental disorder, and there are four criteria that a child needs to meet to be diagnosed with developmental coordination disorder. So the first criterion is that the child has significant difficulties with motor coordination, despite having had ample opportunities to learn and develop motor skills. So the first criterion is that they have difficulties with motor coordination. The second is those difficulties with motor coordination has an impact on their activities of daily living. So that's things like dressing themselves, going to the toilet, using cutlery, their self-care tasks, things at school like handwriting and doing PE, and then play and leisure tasks, things like playing team games, ball games, hitting something with a bat or a stick or something. That those are the sort of things that they have difficulty with in daily living. That's the second criteria. The third one is that the difficulties have been evidenced in the early years. So it's not something that's suddenly come on. It's something that the parents and maybe school have noticed over a period of time. And then the final criterion is that it's not better attributable to another medical diagnosis, such as cerebral palsy or muscular dystrophy. So when a child's been diagnosed with developmental coordination disorder or even an adult, then those four criteria are considered to see whether they meet them. And if they meet the criteria, then they will be given the diagnosis.
Brilliant. Thank you. And I noticed in point three there that you talked about it being evident in the early years. And then you said actually they possibly can be diagnosed with it as an adult. Because actually I was going to ask, is that something, if it's diagnosable in the early years, that they can grow out of, I suppose, for want of a better expression?
So children with milder levels of difficulty can sometimes improve their skills. Generally, the children with the more severe difficulties don't grow out of it generally. So it, for some children, it does change over time, but typically for the children with the more severe difficulties, the more severe motor coordination challenges, it remains throughout childhood and into adulthood.
Excellent. Thank you, Carolyn. And I know that some people, myself included, would have known this disorder as dyspraxia. So can you tell us why there's kind of been a movement away from that name or identifier and kind of moving more towards that developmental coordination disorder label?
Absolutely. There was actually a consensus, an international consensus agreement back in the 90s that we should be calling it developmental coordination disorder. There were a lot of other names, including dyspraxia, around at the time, but it was actually hindering research by calling it lots of different names. If people did a study on dyspraxia and then they did a study on developmental coordination disorder, people didn't know, are we talking about the same children or are they different groups of children or are they subgroups of children? And the reason that developmental coordination disorder was agreed upon is because it comes with those full diagnostic criteria that I just mentioned.
Okay.
So that it's very clear, if you're talking about developmental coordination disorder, these are the sort of children that we're talking about. Although dyspraxia is used very commonly, colloquially, people will talk about dyspraxia. And some people do consider that dyspraxia is a subset or has a unique set of things. And Melissa might want to add more on that. But from a diagnostic point of view, that's the reason why we use DCD.
Excellent. And Melissa, I'll let you come in now because I can see you nodding very vigorously as Carolyn's talking.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm agreeing, of course. Yeah, it's an interesting one because I think in the sort of dyspraxia community, they often talk about this sense of disorganization, or they struggle to sort of manage school bags or calendars or diaries or navigate their environment. And so, you know, many children with DCD or adults with DCD may have those difficulties as well. But I think the point is that not all of them do.
Yeah.
So we know that all children who meet the criteria for developmental coordination disorder, they all have a movement difficulty, but they may not all have these other presentations. The other thing that's really interesting as well is in the UK, there's a lot of advocacy, the Dyspraxia Foundation, for example, around dyspraxia. And I think there's a lot of discussion about identity and the language that we use around identity and whether it's identity first, such as the person is dyspraxic, or if it's person first, a person with developmental coordination disorder or a person with dyspraxia. So I think, as Carolyn said, around colloquialisms and language, there's actually quite a debate there happening, UK specifically. But I think when you're thinking about diagnosis and when you're thinking about research,
yep,
it's so important to be on the same page. And we do know now that we have very clear criteria for diagnosing developmental coordination disorder, but not the term dyspraxia.
Excellent. Thank you. I think it's important, like you say, for the diagnosis point of view, but I imagine also for the kind of support and occupational or physical therapy that would be received after it, then what the distinctions need to be very clear so that their child or adult is kind of getting the most tailored or specific, or their needs are being met in that sense as well. Excellent. And Melissa, are there any risk factors for developmental coordination disorder, or I'll say DCD from now on because I feel like it's a mouthful?
Well, we know it co-occurs with other types of conditions such as ADHD, dyslexia, developmental language disorder, which was formerly known as specific language impairment, and autism. So it can co-occur with those conditions as well. So oftentimes, the severity of how a child presents may be dictated by some of those other things that are going on. But aside from that, there are risk factors associated with having a coordination difficulty in developmental coordination disorder. You know, we know that they struggle with tasks such as running, jumping, throwing, catching, playing, your life skills. They do have a tendency to sometimes withdraw.
Yeah.
From participation.
Yeah.
So they might withdraw from PE or withdraw from playing in the playground, or they don't go to their friends' houses, you know, maybe because they know and they have insight into that they have difficulty. So there are, in some cases, you know, mental health conditions manifesting later in life linked to withdrawal and anxiety, depression. We know too that physical fitness can be a barrier for this group, that if they struggle with some of those coordination skills, they have a tendency to be less active. And so there will be secondary health conditions evolving as a result of that. And interestingly, there's a lot of research happening now in adults in DCD, whereas 10 years ago they wouldn't have been. And so I think as the cohort are aging sort of into older adulthood, it'll be really interesting to be able to track them across the lifespan, because we know it's not just a childhood disorder.
Yeah.
So there are some of the physical and sort of psychological impacts, you know, that some children with DCD may experience.
That's brilliant, Melissa. Thank you. And actually, just off the back of that, I wonder if you could maybe speak to this or comment on what the research is saying. I know you were saying that there might be secondary implications there for mental health if children are withdrawing or maybe not being as socially interactive as they'd like to be, or physical activities if they're not maybe wanting to take part in PE or things. And is there anything in the research, or maybe based on your experience, that teachers or parents can maybe do to encourage these children to still take part in going to a friend's house, or, you know, being sociable, or, you know, because, I mean, obviously you want to respect the child's kind of thoughts and feelings, but equally encourage them to still be part of that friend group. So is there anything there that maybe parents or teachers listening could do?
I think one of the best things that teachers and parents can do is help by understanding.
Yeah.
So not assuming that the child is being lazy or naughty or that they're not trying hard, because this is what the children tell us.
Yeah.
But often these children are trying their very, very hardest and they're still not able to do it. So actually stopping to think, try and look at the effort they're putting in. Are they trying to do this, but they're struggling physically to do it? And actually understanding and rewarding the effort rather than the skill, particularly sort of in PE.
Yeah.
You know, taking part and trying hard, rewarding those things, rather than how many goals you score or what level you achieve with your actual motor skills. And actually talking to the children and finding out what are the things that matter to them.
Yeah.
So certainly my clinical experience, there are some children that are really motivated to do particular things. And despite having a lot of difficulties, if they practice lots, it was the right sort of practice, they learn to do it. So like riding a bike, and Melissa and I have taught lots of children to ride a bike, as long as they want to do it and they're motivated to do it. So that finding out the things that they are keen on, that they want to do, and then helping them to do those, I think is a really good thing. And then problem solving. You know, children sometimes, you know, they don't want to do the sleepover because they're worried about not being able to dress themselves in the morning or wipe themselves after the toilet. Understanding what the barriers are and whether there's anything you could do to actually remove them. Or maybe it's just about understanding that's why you don't want to do it, and maybe we need to wait till you've learned to do those skills.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant, Carolyn. Thank you. And staying with you, Carolyn, what age, I know you said in the right at the start, it does appear in the early years, but at what age are we talking about here in terms of signs or symptoms of DCD likely to show themselves?
Yes. So we've got international clinical guidelines which make recommendations about how we should assess and manage developmental coordination disorder. I'd recommend people to go read that. They're freely available. In those clinical guidelines, it recommends that we shouldn't diagnose DCD under the age of 5.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of variability. From 3 to 5 years of age, there's a lot of variability in motor skills. So it's sort of more unpredictable. However, for children with really severe difficulties, it's recommended that you could consider at the age of 3, but you'd need to do at least 2 assessments 6 months apart.
Okay.
So that you're looking to see that it's really established. But generally, although you would have them see those signs and symptoms and you maybe have some suspicions, that you'd wait till the age of 5 to make that diagnosis to be sure it isn't just that the child hasn't had the experiences or needs a bit longer to practice. But if at 5 the child is meeting the criteria, then definitely that there are some issues.
Yeah, perfect. And you just touched on there the kind of signs or symptoms. So for kind of any parents listening, what are the kind of main things to keep an eye out for?
So they normally reach developmental milestones eventually, maybe at the latter, but they're slower to learn to dress themselves independently,
okay,
to do fastenings. They're often messy eaters, you know, that they eat with their hands, they spill things a lot. They struggle to learn to use cutlery. If cutlery is something using their culture, all that dexterous eating with the hands of boiling rice and eating like that they struggle with those sort of skills, that they often seem very messy and untidy, or the shirt's untucked and the coat's not done up, but it's because they can't do those physical things, or they maybe spilt things on themselves because of the coordination, that they often get quite fatigued.
Okay.
Because they're putting a lot of effort in to do things. So sometimes at the end of the school day, that they're very tired because they've been working very hard to do those physical things. The other thing people talk about is about the children tripping over nothing.
Okay,
They fall over and you can't really see what they fell over, but they just seem to fall. But often they don't. They fall and they get up,
yeah,
and they carry on. But they do seem to fall or stumble or bump into things quite easily.
Okay, great. Well, I mean, those are really helpful things to watch out for. And if a child is kind of showing these signs, or parents might be concerned, and I know you're saying that probably, unless it's a really severe case, give them until 5 or older to, like you say, maybe catch up with learning these more kind of fine motor skills. But what would be the kind of recommended next steps for a parent who's spotted some of these signs and is maybe a little bit concerned?
So they might want to go and talk to their GP in the first instance, talk to the school as well to see whether they've noticed any difficulties. They've obviously seen lots of children,
yeah,
and they'll know whether the child is struggling compared to others their age. Mm-hmm. Particularly if it's the first child, parents don't have something, yeah, to judge by necessarily, or they might be judging against an older child who's actually very coordinated.
Yep.
For instance. But generally, you would want to get a referral to see a paediatrician, because really that last criterion I talked about, it needs a paediatrician or certainly a doctor to make sure there isn't any other reason why the child is having these coordination difficulties, that there isn't another diagnosis going on. And then the paediatrician is likely to refer to occupational therapy and or physiotherapy so that the child can get some support and intervention from somebody with expertise in this area that knows how to help children learn to do the things that matter to them when they have those particular physical difficulties.
That's perfect. And I know you kind of mentioned that earlier, that you and Melissa have both taught children how to ride bikes. So like you say, they're learning skills in a kind of maybe a bit more of a different way, but some things that matter to them and that are important to them. And Carolyn, can you talk us through any practical tips, either from your own clinical experience or from the research, that parents could maybe do in the home to support a child with DCD? Obviously, that would be over and above getting the physical or occupational therapy as well.
Yes. So actually, you know, practicing things, but trying to make it fun. So thinking about things that the child can do to help around the house that's going to get them to actually use their physical skills and to build them up. And so that the child feels they're contributing by helping and doing things, but also it's benefiting them. There are lots of websites and things where you can go and get tips about how to do, but thinking about breaking tasks down. So for instance, tying shoelaces, the two loop method is often an easier way to learn than the one loop and the tie around.
Yeah.
Dressing, it's thinking about making sure that the clothes aren't too difficult, helping them to learn how to sequence the order in which they put the clothes on. Thinking about fastenings. Sometimes it's about working around the problem.
Yep.
And sometimes it's about practicing to develop the skills, but only if the child is really, really motivated to do that. So trying to find some fun activities that the child likes to do, you know, thinking about things that they might want to do, I don't know, in their local leisure centre, something that they're motivated, like trampolining, for instance, or going swimming, and finding a sympathetic coach who will work with them despite the difficulties that they're having. I don't know, Melissa, you might have some other ideas there.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I was going to focus a little bit on the handwriting element in relation to parents, but also some input to schools, if you want to hear a little bit more about that, Hope. But we know that children with DCD struggle quite a lot with handwriting.
Yeah.
They tend to produce less text overall. What they tend to write, because there's fewer words, it's less interesting to read. They might have lower scores on spelling, grammar, punctuation, idea development, sort of all of those writing skills. And they're directly impacted by their handwriting speed. So we've done studies that show that the number of words that a child can write in a minute predicts how much they would write in a free writing task, but also how good that composition is, how good the writing actually is. And that relationship is really strong no matter what group you research. But we know in children with DCD that their writing quality can be below their peers, driven by the lack of speed in their handwriting. And so speed is an indicator of how automatic handwriting is, how easily they can retrieve the letters from memory and get them out onto the page. Yeah. And the more automatic that is, the more they can think about their ideas, their vocabulary. And if it's not automatic, they're really thinking about how to get those letters on the page, and they don't have capacity to think about much else. So we know that children with DCD can struggle with handwriting speed, and it can be less legible. So when, you know, parents will see this as the child starts to develop speed, handwriting may become an issue. But, you know, tips for dealing with that is sort of looking at how the school is teaching handwriting and trying as much as possible to support letter practice little and often at home. But I'm saying that with a four-year-old daughter who's currently learning how to handwrite, and her teacher is the boss. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether I have a PhD on handwriting difficulties in children, her teacher calls the shot. Well, that's not what my teacher said, so therefore I'm not going to listen to you.
You don't know what you're talking about, Mum.
Right. So the power really is with the school when it comes to handwriting. And so if there's any teachers sort of listening, you know, you can't underestimate the importance of a handwriting policy. And I know teachers are so busy. I mean, they have 50,000 things to focus on in the curriculum. But, you know, the handwriting speed relationship with writing quality is just so significant. So if you're in a school, what you want is your year five and year six students to be able to write quickly, to get their thoughts down on paper in a way that's functional. You can read it and it's quick.
Yeah.
So if you've got children who are struggling, your policy is going to be so important. So how are you teaching handwriting from reception? Are you aware of the Ofsted announcement to say don't teach continuous cursive from reception? Mm-hmm. They're now saying to don't do the entry strokes. So if you've got three classes in a year group, are all of the teachers teaching handwriting in the same way? Are they using the same language? Are they using the same direction of strokes? When they go from reception to year one, to year two, to year three, to a different teacher, is that teacher teaching it in the same way that they learned the year before? And the thing is that most children will just catch up, or, you know, they'll just go along with it. But you'll have children who really can't do that. And so we know that children with DCD, they are able to learn a motor skill. We can see that in studies. They are able to learn a motor skill, but we know it takes them longer. Again, we can see that in data, and they need more practice. So if you're working in a school, the importance of having consistent teaching and a consistent policy across your year groups and classes is so important for them. What you'll see over the summer break anyway is that handwriting drops off a cliff for everybody, right? So if you can imagine a child with coordination difficulties coming back in September to a new teacher with a new way of doing, that's going to be really difficult for them.
Absolutely.
So I would say a handwriting policy for schools is hugely important, and then communicating with parents how to support that at home.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it's funny, you're trying to negotiate with your daughter.
Yeah,
it's not working. You know what you're talking about. It's fine.
Yeah. Don't mind me.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that is really important, just to kind of emphasize the, like you say, the power the teacher has, but also then that communication with the parents in terms of reiterating what's going on in the classroom so that the parents can help support that in the home. And Melissa, I know that you touched on it there, your expertise is in handwriting, despite what your daughter might say if we ask her. And I know that you're working on a grant at the moment called Writing in the Digital Age, Keyboard versus Pen in Adolescents with Handwriting Difficulties. So would you be able to talk to us just a little bit about that project? Because I'm sure there actually would be loads of teachers listening that would be interested to hear, especially with the increased usage of kind of different technologies in the classroom.
Yeah, so what we're trying to understand in this study is how handwriting difficulties sort of can be mitigated for the GCSEs. So we know from some of the qualitative studies that we've done that, you know, some children can get a keyboard to do their GCSEs on, and it can be an informal arrangement in the school or in a local setting. There's obviously the formal accommodations, but there are a lot of students out there who do their GCSEs in an informal way using a laptop or a word processor. So what we've been trying to do is to understand the impact on mode, so handwriting versus typing, on writing quality, so that we can make a decision about if a child has a handwriting difficulty, should they type their GCSEs or should they handwrite their GCSEs? So we know that handwriting speed is so important to writing quality. It's the exact same thing with typing. Typing speed is really important. So if you're hunting and pecking, you're not going to write much and it's not going to be much good. So the same relationship applies to both modes. So the question in our study is, you know, we're going to assess adolescents with handwriting difficulties, both handwriting and typing some text. And we're going to see which mode, handwriting or typing, produces the best text. So grammar, punctuation, spelling, organization, cohesion, all of those things that they're actually marked on in the GCSEs. So we're recruiting students from year 8 and 9 who have a handwriting difficulty. And that study is running now. So if there are any schools who are interested in taking part in that, please do get in touch. But we hope that it will provide some evidence for decision making in a more robust way about who gets what type of support and when.
Yeah, brilliant. And I think that sounds like it would be really interesting to hear the results of. Because I remember when you and Carolyn did a webinar for us on DCD, actually, and you did produce some examples of a child with handwriting difficulty and a child with handwriting. I was really shocked, actually, at the difference just even in the amount of words that had been produced in the same amount of time and the kind of legibility of it. So no, that'll be really interesting to hear, especially for important exams like GCSEs. Thank you, Melissa. And this is to both of you. I know that both of you are part of the kind of developmental coordination disorder Big Ideas group, which is a large consortium of 25 researchers across 9 countries, which is absolutely amazing. And as part of that consortium, you've identified 3 main streams, which include raising awareness of DCD, profiling and subtyping DCD, and intervention for DCD. So would you be able to just talk us through each of these streams?
Yeah, so the DCD Big Ideas group has got 3 strands of work. The first one is around awareness, and trying to build awareness out in the general public, because, you know, we often talk about other conditions like autism or ADHD, which have the same type of prevalence in numbers, but are much more known out to the general public. So what we've been trying to do is to raise awareness through creating video content, through writing pieces for mainstream media platforms, and trying to get the message out a little bit across the 9 countries that we're from. The other strand is around profiling, you know, to better understand how children with DCD present and what are the best ways to assess them. The idea being that we look to develop new and contemporary ways of assessing people with DCD. And the third strand of work is around intervention, to see what works. There's been a lot of research done on intervention to date. So one of the strands we're looking at is a systematic review, a scoping review as well. I think there's lots of scoping and systematic reviews happening just to see where we are in the literature exactly. The idea being that we would then identify gaps and start submitting applications to look at some of the big problems moving forward. So I'll pass over to Carolyn to talk about, you know, the messages that came out of our most recent event at Brunel, which Carolyn was coordinating.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think that's actually, yeah, I was about to ask about it, Carolyn. You were just saying that was the third meeting, I think, at Brunel. So glad, excited to hear about it.
Yeah, so the first meeting was in the Czech Republic.
Okay.
The second meeting was in Holland, in Nijmegen. And then the third meeting was at Brunel. We haven't quite decided where our next meeting is going to be. And it's really exciting, though, to have people from so many different countries. And of course, that can speak different languages.
Yep.
So it means that we're actually accessing research from a range of countries. Like we have some Iranians in the group, and there's been quite a bit of research done there that we wouldn't typically have accessed. We've got a lot of Dutch speakers. They've been doing a lot of work in DCD, as well as some people from Spain, as well as the English speakers. So it's giving us access to a much wider range because it's an international symposium. And we're really keen to, as Melissa says, to work on this raising awareness. So being involved in things like this is obviously helping. And we'll be looking to share some of the content that we've put together for raising awareness, looking at sort of public facing platforms. But we've also written as a group an article that's aimed at a more academic peer-reviewed journal that has brought together all the knowledge from all those different aspects. And it's intended to be a key article that people can use when they're applying for funding to do further research into the areas where we still don't know enough about developmental coordination disorder, that like we've gathered all the information into one place that everybody can use, and then they can translate it into Czech or Dutch or Spanish or whatever they need to do to use it to look for funding, because we still have a lot to learn. I think that was one of the messages that's come through, that we do know a lot more than we did. You know, in the 35 years I've been working in this field, things have progressed in our understanding, but it's still not got that awareness out there. And there's still a lot we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We're still not quite sure how to best profile the children. There's a range, you know, we look at lots of studies and they have difficulties with lots of different things. What is the best way that we identify the areas of difficulty that we have, and then the secondary consequences, such as, you know, their executive functioning is something that's emerged in recent years that they have difficulty with that. How do we best understand that? How do we help it? There's been more brain imaging studies that have been done and that's becoming more sophisticated in our understanding about the differences in the brains of children with and without DCD. So gathering that information into one place. Thinking about the intervention, so we do have some guidance from the international guidelines. We do know that there are some effective interventions that children with DCD can improve their skills with the right sort of intervention. But we need a lot more research. We're not sure exactly how much they need, whether there are different types of intervention that we could develop, that we could make sure that we really optimize the skills that they have, and how do we learn from all these different countries and understand what the options are if you're developing something to help the children. Yeah, so we're all going away to do some more research, trying to understand better and to think about what the direction should be, what's the most important thing to understand so that we can help the children.
Brilliant. No, that's perfect. And that was a brilliant summary of what was discussed at the symposium. If it was only, how long was it? A couple of days or a week?
It was 2 days. We all gathered on a Wednesday night, and it's very social as well. We have meals together. We went all day Thursday. We worked together. Then we went to a walking tour in Windsor to show off the UK. Then we worked all day on Friday. We had the videographer come and record people from the different countries being interviewed. We've got those three groups, so we worked together in the groups on our projects to progress the things that we were doing. And then we went out for a meal on Friday night, and Saturday morning there was a hike for those that wanted it.
Wow.
So there's a social program as well as quite a full-on academic program.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 2 days is the things that you've just summarized. I was thinking that was at least a week's worth of work, but crammed into 2 days. That's amazing. And I know that you said that kind of some of the plans is to go off and do some more research on your respective areas. And you mentioned the videographer there, and I know you were talking about actually a conversation, an article coming out in The Conversation as well, which we'll definitely link to, because I think all of that goes towards raising awareness. But are there any kind of solid proposed plans moving forward?
Well, we're about to be, the article that I said for the, I'm not sure, it's either just about to be or just has been submitted.
Excellent.
To a journal. So the people that are working on the systematic scoping review of interventions, they are actually critiquing all of the papers. They're working their way through that to identify which are the papers that are going to inform the overall recommendations.
Excellent.
And then the people that are looking at the profiling and subtyping are also looking at potentially developing an app that could be used in developing low income countries.
Brilliant.
Because we do have people from Africa as well who are interested in thinking about how we could, they can't afford to buy these standardized assessments that we typically use to make that diagnosis for that first criterion, assessing whether they do have difficulties with coordination more than other children or their age. So they're looking at developing something that will enable people with limited resources to be able to do those assessments.
Excellent. No, that's amazing, and actually answers my next question, which was what the future of DCD research and practice looks like. So that's very exciting to hear about the app getting developed, especially for those lower resourced countries that maybe can't afford the assessments, but obviously still will have children who need support. Melissa, have you got anything to, I feel like Carolyn's given a brilliant description, but have you got anything to add on from your experiences at the DCD Big Symposium?
I think it's just nice to get these people together, get heads together, and to start looking at some of the bigger problems. I think it will build capacity and numbers in terms of the amount of children that we're capturing in research. It'll capture, you know, across countries, so, you know, cross-cultural differences, and it will also help us to just sort of understand the condition more thoroughly from using bigger data sets. Interprofessional working will be really important. If you look at our group, we come from all sorts of different backgrounds. Carolyn and I happen to be an OT, but there are physical educators, movement scientists, you name it. We come from different backgrounds. And I think that that's really important to be able to address research questions thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, I would agree from my kind of background in research. I think it's great to hear from different aspects because everyone comes at things differently. So, and might have kind of a different list of priorities based on what their work and practice looks like. So always great to hear from lots of people. So very exciting that you're a part of this big group. Yes, Carolyn.
It's also worth mentioning that there's an International Development Coordination Disorder scientific meeting next year. How often do they happen, Melissa? Every 2 years?
Yeah.
These come round. So it's in Bruges next year. So it's DCD 15, that one. So we're hoping that we'll be meeting up with quite a few of our colleagues there and other people from America, Canada, Australia, around the world.
Excellent.
It'll be a gathering of people sharing the research in DCD. The DCD Big Group will be there sharing their research, but we'll be looking forward to hearing what other people are doing as well.
Definitely. It sounds like a really exciting area with a lot of very kind of eager people kind of working really hard to push this research and practice forward. So that's fantastic. I know that we touched on little bits and pieces, but what evidence-based resources would, I'll come to both of you on it, what resources would you point educators towards to kind of help support children that might have DCD in their classroom?
I think for me, with my handwriting sort of typing hat on, the National Handwriting Association is a charity in the UK with a focus on supporting best practice in the teaching and learning of handwriting. So there's some good resources on there for schools and OTs. I'd also recommend CanChild in terms of knowing more about what DCD is. They have some fantastic resources on there, including some modules that parents and clinicians can work their way through. Carolyn?
Yeah, I'd certainly endorse CanChild. Has a lot of wonderful resources and resources for educators as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that there are various things that you can go and do. You can, as you say, work through modules or just information. There's also DCD Australia. It's a really good evidence-based website that has gathered a lot of information. It's around the world, but also it's got stuff aimed at teachers. It's got stuff aimed at parents, stuff aimed at professionals. We've already mentioned the Dyspraxia Foundation as a resource. And if you're looking for something more academic, then I'd recommend going to the International Clinical Guidelines on Developmental Coordination Disorder. They're a long read, but they've gathered all the information together in one place based on high quality evidence such as systematic reviews. So certainly it's worth going to them as a resource, and they're due to be updated. They came out in 2019, so I think they're due to be updated next year, and I think people are already working on updating the systematic reviews they were based on.
Fantastic. Thank you, both of you. Melissa, I know that you're working, we've talked a little bit about your Writing in the Digital Age project. Is there any other interesting projects that you're working on at the moment?
We have a few initiatives going on. One of the things that we have at the minute here is sort of a children's research clinic in West London, where we're creating placements for occupational therapy students to go out into schools to work in the schools at whole class level. So when I talked about handwriting policies in schools, this is one of the things that our occupational therapy students have been helping our local schools to do. And we also have volunteering in our curriculum now. I think our OT students do about 15,000 hours of volunteering. So, and they live all over London. So these are some of the outreach initiatives that we've been trying to do that would have some impact, you know, to sort of support schools and build capacity around helping children with DCD and, of course, other difficulties. And then on the research front, the focus for now is really looking at handwriting and typing and skills like cycling, which are really important and meaningful to children. Carolyn, what are you working on?
So I'm really focusing on knowledge transfer. So I have a community of practice called Mind the Gap, which supports occupational therapists to deliver evidence-based practice, so helping them to go to the guidelines and think about their services that they run in their children's centres and how do they actually make sure that the services they offer are supported by the most recent up-to-date evidence. And of course, it's changing all of the time. So people need, clinicians are busy, they need to be supported to actually go and find the evidence, make sense of it and apply it to their settings in the most effective way.
Brilliant. Thank you. That's all the questions I have for you both. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. It's been really, really fantastic to hear about all the exciting work that you're doing with the big group and at Brunel. And yeah, look forward to linking to all your videos when they come out and the conversation article as well. So thank you again, both, for your time.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Hope.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.